Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top stories of the past week. A top story today, once again, concerns the ongoing agony at the Fukushima site. A number of recent developments. First of all, tuna. Tuna that's been caught in the Pacific has registered trace amounts of radioactive cesium from the nuclear power plant accident. Not only that, but some nuclear engineers have raised the red flag, saying that Unit 4, containing large quantities of spent waste, is totally exposed to the air, and a secondary earthquake could tip it over, creating an explosion which would exceed that of Chernobyl. And once again, we have to worry about the debris field, the tremendous debris field left over from the tsunami, which is now landing on U.S. soil. Also, a piece of good news, and that is SpaceX, a private corporation funded by the billionaire who started PayPal, has scored a success in launching the Falcon 9 rocket. It was also a test, by the way, of President Obama's new space program. Can outer space be commercialized, thereby shifting the burden away from the taxpayer and putting it on the shoulders of visionary billionaires? And then we'd like to bring on our special guest today. We're going to bring on a pre-recorded interview with Michael Marriott that we conducted after the Fukushima disaster. He's the head of the Nuclear Information Resource Service, which is the main organization in the country, basically a clearinghouse for information on everything that is nuclear. Well, let's just jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. Our top story today concerns Japan. First of all, the former Prime Minister of Japan, the Prime Minister that you saw on national TV practically every night in March of last year, has come out with an astonishing statement rarely heard by any former Prime Minister. And that is, at the height of the accident, he was seriously contemplating evacuating 30 million people from the city of Tokyo if the accident spirals out of control. And at one point, it looked like he would have to evacuate Tokyo. And then he realized that's impossible. How can you possibly evacuate 30 million people in a few hours? And then he realized that any such evacuation plan would ruin the entire country of Japan as an industrialized nation. In other words, in modern history, we've never seen the total destruction of a modern industrial nation other than in war. Here, the former Prime Minister of Japan had to contemplate what would it be like to essentially give the death warrant to Japan as an industrialized nation. At that point, he realized that nuclear cannot be in the future of Japan. Japan is riddled with earthquake faults. In fact, three major faults collide in Japan, and as a consequence, the danger of another earthquake is quite large. Recently, just a few months ago, some Tokyo University seismologists estimated that the chance of a Tokyo earthquake, a mammoth Tokyo earthquake, was perhaps 70% in the next 10 years. That's huge, huge. And it means that any scientist, any emergency worker in Japan has to come to grips with the fact that Fukushima might have been just basically a warm-up, because the population around Fukushima is basically uninhabited, while Tokyo realized that about 10% of all Japanese people resides in the greater Tokyo area. However, we should also point out that the new prime minister disagrees. The new prime minister has stated that he believes in nuclear energy, and in fact, even though all nuclear plants in Japan are currently offline, he wants to restart some of the nuclear power plants that were shut down for routine maintenance, but right now are permanently shut down until further notice. Meanwhile, a nuclear scientist in Japan is raising once again worries about Unit 4. We heard about the dangers of Unit 1, 2, and 3, hydrogen gas explosion, total meltdown of uranium. Unit 4 is actually perhaps the most worrisome at all. It contains nuclear waste. Large quantities of nuclear waste comparable to that of Chernobyl, and it is fully exposed to the air. Think of a pond, A pond containing thousands of hot nuclear fuel rods. Water has to be on top of the fuel rods at all time, and the whole structure has to be encased in case of an accident. Well, the hydrogen gas bubble blew off the containment structure of Unit 4, exposing it to the air. And it's simply so radioactive, that robots and people have not been able to recover the Unit 4 spent fuel pond. Now, the danger is, let's say there's a secondary earthquake or a fire or an explosion. Very likely something like that could happen. At that point, the pond has a crack and bleeds off the water. As the water levels drop, it begins to rise in temperature. It boils off and accelerates the evacuation of water from the spent fuel pond. At that point, a chemical explosion could be generated because of the hydrogen gas, which is created by the hot fuel. Somebody, for example, with a spark, a cigarette lighter, could create a chemical explosion which will blow these rods apart, exposing large quantities of nuclear waste directly into the atmosphere. This would be a Chernobyl-like disaster. And it's just sitting there, totally exposed. Gigantic quantities of nuclear fuel rods, and the slightest secondary earthquake, and there have been hundreds of them, by the way, since the Fukushima disaster, but a large secondary earthquake could create what is called a boil-off and a hydrogen gas explosion, which would be the beginning of the end. Not to mention the fact that the debris field from all the nuclear waste, from all the disaster, the broken hopes and dreams of the Japanese people, are now beginning to land on U.S. soil. Now, let's be very clear about this. We don't think the debris is that radioactive at all. It's had quite a while to dilute. It's had quite a while to be in the ocean. The main danger is poisonous or dangerous chemicals that still may lurk among this gigantic debris field. And watch out, there could even be human body parts among them because thousands of people are still unaccounted for after the Fukushima disaster of last year. Now, the debris field, no one's going to eat the debris field. However, tuna is something that is prized by many nations in Asia and, of course, in the United States. Now, tuna has now been declared to be slightly contaminated with cesium, radioactive cesium from the disaster. Now, we don't want to start a panic. Radiation levels are rather low. And, however, we have to realize that there could be hotspots. In the future, there could be radioactive hotspots from the disaster, and it has to be monitored very carefully. Now, in the field, we have an expression, quote, "The solution to pollution is dilution," meaning that for the most part, the Pacific Ocean has diluted much of the nuclear waste and nuclear contamination from Fukushima. However, there are hotspots. However, there are ocean currents which don't mix the nuclear waste evenly. And therefore, we have to watch out that tuna may actually concentrate radiation in the tissue. And this is something that we have to look at very carefully, especially in the coming years, especially in the future, as we have to monitor more and more debris washing up on our shores and perhaps other forms of sea life like kelp and seaweed that also are contaminated by the Fukushima disaster. Also, there's a piece of good news for a change. And that is, if you look at outer space, President Barack Obama's controversial plan to commercialize outer space may be bearing fruit. As you know, President Barack Obama canceled the space shuttle. He canceled the replacement for the space shuttle. He canceled the moon program. And he canceled the Mars program. In other words, right across the board, President Barack Obama single-handedly canceled the entire space program. And we have to rely on the Russians now for access to the International Space Station. Some people say that could be dangerous in case of a nuclear confrontation somewhere in the world. We're staring eyeball to eyeball with the Russians again. Well, they can simply shut off our space program by simply denying us access to Kazakhstan and their Energia booster rocket. Well, President Barack Obama, to be fair, has an ace in the hole. And that is the commercialization of outer space. That's where PayPal comes in. The billionaire who founded PayPal is now using some of his private money to fund something called SpaceX, a corporation which is manufacturing the Falcon 9 rocket. The Falcon 9 rocket is a totally commercially funded rocket of course, eventually paid for by U.S. taxpayers, which will purchase the rocket, but it gains access to the International Space Station and had a perfect launch last week, and it is now docking with the International Space Station. So here's a situation where we actually have a little glimmer of hope, and that is perhaps the commercial side of the space program can compensate for the fact that taxpayers simply are broke and don't have the money to pay for an elaborate space program. Realize that to put a pound of anything into orbit, near Earth orbit, well, it costs about $10,000. That's your weight in gold. Think of your body made out of solid gold, put it into near Earth orbit, and that costs about $10,000. To put you on the moon costs you roughly $100,000 a pound. To put you on Mars costs roughly $1 million a pound, or basically your weight in diamonds. So in other words, there's a dirty little secret to the space program. What is the basic problem? The problem is a four-letter word beginning with C, cost. The cost of space travel is enormous. Now, to be sure, nations like Russia and the United States were willing to foot the bill because our national honor was at stake. The destiny of the countries were thought to lie in outer space. Therefore, people forked out the money to support a vigorous space program. Now that the Cold War is over, and now that we have this huge economic crisis, people are beginning to think, well, maybe the taxpayers can't afford this huge bill, especially given the fact that life support is very expensive in outer space. Now realize that scientists take a slightly different point of view. Scientists are not interested so much in the manned space program. They're interested in the robotic exploration of space. Robots can go where no humans have gone before. They can go whizzing to Mars, whizzing to Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and on to Pluto. Humans, on the other hand, we spend 99.999% of the time simply spinning wheels around the Earth and once in a while slingshotting ourselves to the moon. The scientists say, ha, we can get fabulous amounts of information using robotic probes, which are much cheaper and don't use much life support. Well, the problem is that if we cut back on the manned space program, then the robotic space program is also cut back, and so both of them begin to suffer. Now, I think personally that scientists have to make a better case to the American people about the benefits of the space program. Realize that almost all of modern society depends upon the space program. Weather satellites, GPS, the internet, Google Maps even. All of that is done through the satellites. In fact, perhaps you're listening to this radio show, Compliments of a Satellite. And so we can never underestimate the enormous implications of the space program, not to mention the fact that the miniaturization program, which started in the space program, has spread to the commercial electronics industry, giving us this fantastic explosion in computer power over the last few decades. So the next time you use an iPad or an iPod, remember that you owe it all to the space program. The space program is where much of these technologies got started. And personally, I still remember when LBJ, President Lyndon Baines Johnson, came on television when a gigantic hurricane was barreling its way to Texas. Realized that back in those days, we didn't have weather satellites, but the Tyro satellite went into orbit and photographed a gigantic hurricane headed toward Texas, which gave people advanced warning, saving perhaps hundreds, thousands of lives, and allowing businesses to hunker down to withstand the brunt of a gigantic hurricane. So for the first time in human history, we had advanced, detailed warning of a massive hurricane barreling its way toward Texas. And then I still remember LBJ came on TV and said, today, the space program has paid for itself many times over. And you know something? He was right in that just one picture from the Tyro space satellite from outer space, we had valuable information that saved lives, that saved property, that paid for the entire space program many times over. The danger, however, is that we get complacent. The danger is that we say ho-hum and we forget the enormous debt that we owe the space program. And so remember that for every dollar we put into the space program, we get back more than that in terms of scientific progress, and also, by the way, in terms of inspiring the next generation of scientists to become pioneers in science and technology.
I'd like to introduce our special guest today. We're very delighted to have with us Michael Marriott, a director at NIRS, the Nuclear Information Resource Service in Washington. And we're going to talk today about the Fukushima nuclear accident 5 months later. What about the long-term implications? What about the cleanup operation? What's happening in Europe? What about President Barack Obama's plan to have a nuclear renaissance? These and other questions we'll discuss with Michael Marriott of the Nuclear Information Resource Service, NIRS. Michael, first question for you is, explain, what is NIRS?
Well, NIRS is Nuclear Information and Resource Service. We're an organization founded in 1978 to serve what was then and remains today a very decentralized grassroots movement against nuclear power and for safe and clean energy sources. We work to achieve a nuclear-free, carbon-free energy future. And we monitor what's happening in Washington as well as around the world, really, get the information to the people across the country, help them understand it, and help them use it. We have a website at NIRS.org, and we also have three different Facebook pages, and we're on Twitter, so our outreach is getting pretty good.
Okay, so what is your spin on the Fukushima nuclear accident? Many people have analyzed it, but what are your thoughts? How severe was the accident? And then, of course, we'll talk about the long-term implications.
Well, of course, in Fukushima, we had multiple meltdowns, something few people ever thought would happen. We had multiple fuel pool failures, something few people ever thought would happen, and we had them all at the same time. In a lot of ways, this was the most challenging nuclear accident ever. It remains to be seen whether it will eventually rank as the most catastrophic nuclear accident ever, or whether we'll be, right up there with Chernobyl or not, because, one key thing is that, this is an accident that isn't over. The reactors continue to leak radiation. Currently, according to our best information, the levels are much, much lower than they were a few months ago, but they are still continuing at about a billion becquerels per hour, according to our best information. At the height of the accident, just for comparison, they were putting out hundreds of thousands of trillions of becquerels per day. So it's obviously it's gone down. But none of the reactors are yet in cold shutdown, which means there is still the possibility that new problems could occur, particularly through another earthquake or operator error or any of a number of various potential problems. And it just today, in fact, Tokyo Electric Power admitted that they're probably not going to make cold shutdown by next January as they've been planning. So we still have months to go before we can say this accident is contained. And then even then, we're going to have years and probably decades of pretty dicey cleanup of the mess that's left there. I mean, we have molten fuel at the bottom of three reactors. That's going to be an enormous task to try to deal with over the years. We've got hundreds of thousands of tons of contaminated water in these buildings. Again, that's going to be an enormous cleanup effort. So this is something that's going to be ongoing for a good long time.
And how severe was the accident? We now know from TEPCO's own admission that all three reactors suffered a 100% core melt. All the uranium melted. But what about breachment of containment? Is there any indication that the metal that surrounded the reactors actually began to melt and perhaps even leaked out some molten uranium?
It's very clear that there was indeed a breach of containment. Even the Nuclear Regulatory Commission admits that for at least some of the reactors. In fact, just before we began this interview, I was reading the Fukushima Task Force report, and it acknowledges that there was indeed breach of containment. We don't know how severe the breaches were because nobody can, of course, get there to take a look. The radiation levels are too high. But we also know that it's far more severe than Japan let on initially. And in particular, our belief is that the Unit 3 in particular, we believe there was probably an explosion in the fuel pool there, and that caused the fuel fragments to be blown across the area, across the site. And we think that's what accounts for some very extraordinarily high radiation readings that were found at Fukushima earlier this month. You know, the highest readings yet, and we believe that this is because there are, you know, basically pieces of hot fuel around the site that haven't been measured yet, and there's probably pieces of hot fuel throughout the evacuation zone with extraordinarily high levels of radiation. And again, this is something that's going to take months and years to deal with.
And what about the contamination that continues to come out of the reactor? What about contamination that's affected drinking water, milk, vegetation, farm products, fish? What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, Japan has a very serious problem with contamination of food stuff right now. There have been numerous reports of contaminated beef, contaminated mushrooms, contaminated tea. I think the entire country is holding its breath now as the rice harvest is getting ready to go to market to see how contaminated that may be. And you know, most of this contamination is caused by the the initial releases early in the accident that were spewed over a large part of the countryside, especially to the northwest of the plant. But if you look at the radiation maps, just all over the place, 100, 120 miles away, there's hot spots that are quite contaminated. And so the contamination of elements like cesium-137 and others, it gets into the soil, the plant-based food sort of takes it up inside the food, and it becomes contaminated. The cattle were eating contaminated straw and hay. They ingest the radioactive cesium, and then the cattle themselves become radioactive. And it's a very serious problem throughout Japan. Another problem I want to bring up is that large areas of northern Japan that should have been evacuated, that are continuing to experience contamination levels higher than those the Soviet Union evacuated as a result of the 1986 Chernobyl disaster. Hundreds of thousands of people are living in areas like this and not being evacuated, probably more appropriately called relocated at this point. And we have situations such as we posted one on Facebook today where you literally have government officials going door to door in certain towns with radiation monitors, and they'll tell people in one household, you can evacuate, we will compensate you, and next door they'll say, you can't because we don't find a hot spot on your land. So it's a very ad hoc way of dealing with this issue, and in our view, a very cruel way of dealing with this issue. And the fact remains, we have hundreds of thousands of people, tens of thousands of children living in zones that are contaminated that should be evacuated. And I'll just make a pitch for this. We have a petition up on our website that we are working on in conjunction with our friends at Green Action Japan, an emergency petition to protect the children of Fukushima, and we hope people will sign that. In the early days of the accident, we sent over a number of radiation monitors to Japan through Green Action, and it was through these monitors that the scandal of the radiation levels at Fukushima schools were first discovered. So we were very happy to be part of this effort and part of what's a very a rapidly growing movement of mothers in Japan, you know, mothers in particular, to relocate their children into safer areas. But now that we have the information, now we need to bring about the political change to make it possible.
Now, the Japanese people are normally rather trusting of the government, and now we have a situation where people are buying decimeters and Geiger counters on their own, that local municipalities are giving out decimeters to children as young as kindergarten age. So do you see, therefore, that there's a sea change in people's attitude toward nuclear power in Japan?
Absolutely. And you're quite right. You know, the Japanese people had been told for many years, many decades, and this is partly in response to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that they've been told by their government that, yes, nuclear weapons are horrible, look what happened to us, but nuclear power is going to help Japan. And they were assured over and over again of safety, even while the government and the utilities in Japan built nuclear reactors on fault lines and failed to take steps to protect reactors from tsunamis, built reactors such as the General Electric Mark I design, which is what was used at Fukushima, that have received numerous safety criticisms over the years. And the Japanese people, I think, now realize they were sold a bill of goods.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for the first part of Exploration. Once again, we began an interview with Michael Marriott, director of the Nuclear Information Resource Service in Washington, D.C., a nuclear clearinghouse of information. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. So stay tuned now for the second half of Exploration as we continue the discussion of the Fukushima accidents and the future of nuclear energy. Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we began a discussion with Michael Marriott of the Nuclear Information Resource Service in Washington, D.C., and in this segment of Exploration, we're going to continue a discussion of the Fukushima reactor accident and its aftermath. What actually happened at Fukushima, how extensive was the damage? What about the cleanup operation? And, of course, what about the international impact of that accident? What about Germany, Switzerland, Italy? What about the United States? And what about nuclear waste disposal? And whatever happened to the nuclear renaissance that was supposed to reinvigorate the sagging fortunes of nuclear energy? Once again, our special guest in this hour is Michael Marriott of the Nuclear Information Resource Service. Okay, now at Three Mile Island, there was no breach of containment, and yet it took 14 years to clean up. The crews had to put in TV cameras to photograph the melted core, and then with hacksaws, hack up the core into pieces and take each piece out, all of which took place underwater. And that was 14 years for a situation that was relatively under control. Do you foresee, therefore, that the cleanup operation at Fukushima could be many times worse?
Absolutely. Three Mile Island was quite easy compared to Fukushima. In fact, I was actually inside Three Mile Island watching the workers practice with these tools they were using. They were these very long-handled tools, about 20 feet long, and like you said, they would stand on this little ledge and try to cut molten fuel 20 feet below them underwater. And that was very easy compared to what's going to happen at Fukushima, because at Three Mile Island, the fuel remained in the reactor pressure vessel. It was in a relatively small location. At Fukushima, it is melted and has moved out of the vessel. We don't know how far out yet. We may not even know that for years. So, yeah, I think we're looking at literally decades for cleanup. I know a couple months ago, Tokyo Electric Power received bids from two different companies for cleanup activities. One of the bids said, well, we think we can do it in 10 years, and the other bid said, well, we think we can do it in 30 years. And I think what we're really going to be looking at is decades before we actually have a cleaned-up situation at Fukushima. I mean, remember that Chernobyl was 25 years ago. At Chernobyl, they built the sarcophagus fairly quickly, the large steel container around the site, but the sarcophagus at Chernobyl is not adequate, and so they're just now beginning work 25 years later on a more permanent sealing of that reactor. Fukushima is more spread out. There was damage over a wider area. It's going to be extraordinarily difficult and time-consuming and expensive to try to bring about to any sort of normalcy level.
Now, you mentioned 10 to 30-year estimates. One nuclear engineer has estimated that it may take as long as 100 years, a century, to clean up. At Chernobyl, there were 600,000 workers that were involved in that cleanup operation. 600,000 workers. Some of the workers only went in for a few minutes, getting a full year's dose of radiation. So what are your thoughts? Do you think it's going to take more than 30 years, maybe 50 years? These are the numbers being batted about now.
Well, I think at one level, it's just impossible to know. And I mean, I think we're looking at decades easily. How many decades really depends on what is found, under these reactors, inside these reactor buildings, when people can finally get into them, and we don't even know when that is going to be. So somebody wants to say a century, I'm not going to disagree with them. It's just impossible to know now, but it's going to be quite a long time, and it's going to be extraordinarily expensive.
Okay, now let's talk about the radioactive fallout from the Fukushima disaster. Just before the nuclear accident, people were saying that there's going to be a nuclear renaissance. that there's going to be a new emphasis on building safer designs of nuclear power, especially in light of the greenhouse effect, that nuclear could be the white knight, with President Barack Obama even endorsing a nuclear renaissance. So let's take it one country at a time. First of all, Germany. What's happening in Germany?
Well, Germany, you know, has had a nuclear phase-out policy in place in the previous government. The current government overturned that policy when they came to power, Angela Merkel's Christian Democratic Party. Now that party and Ms. Merkel have done an about-face, and Germany, in fact, is going to accelerate its nuclear phase-out. Seven reactors are already closed, and the other, I believe it's another 12 that they have, are going to permanently close around the end of this decade. And there is a clear commitment not to build any more. So Germany is leading the way to a non-nuclear future. And what's especially important about Germany, I think, is that they want to do this and are planning to do this in a way that switches them from nuclear and from fossil fuels to renewable sources of power and increased energy efficiency. This is the future that they now see as not only desirable but feasible, and they are likely to show the rest of the world the way to do this. And they're, in that sense, they're going to be a terrific example for the rest of the world.
And what about Switzerland?
Switzerland also is ending its use of nuclear power. They won't be building any more. They will be. They have a scheduled phase out for their existing reactors. They only have one or two. They're not nearly as reliant on nuclear as Germany is. And their phase out, I believe, is at a later date than Germany's. They're not making as radical a statement as Germany is at this point. But the trend there again is clear. And you know, one thing to remember about countries like Germany and Switzerland is these are not the kinds of countries you normally think of as sort of sunny resort areas, and yet these countries are going to be moving aggressively to solar power. In fact, Germany is already the most solar country in the world, and when people understand that countries like this can effectively use solar power, it's very clear that those of us in parts of the world that actually do have greater solar resources, there's no excuse for us not to do it.
And what about Italy?
Italy is interesting because the government there, Berlusconi's government, wanted to renew construction of nuclear power. In Italy, after Chernobyl, there was a referendum, and the people voted no more nuclear. Berlusconi's government has been actively working to overturn that over the last couple of years. And in fact, the Italian utilities have been investing in nuclear plants in other countries, but they wanted to build more in Italy. Well, they had another citizens' referendum just about 6-8 weeks ago, in which the government actively opposed, but the referendum won by some 90% of the vote, and Italy will very clearly not be building more nuclear power plants.
And going back to Japan, Japan, some people say, made the Faustian bargain. Faust was the mythical figure who sold his soul to the devil for unlimited power. Japan has very few alternatives, no coal, no oil, very little hydropower, so they went nuclear. So what's going to happen now with the future of nuclear energy in Japan?
Well, clearly Japan is going to be much, much less reliant on nuclear power than it has been. And the only question is, will it be reliant at all on nuclear power? Most of Japan's reactors are closed. Japan had 55 reactors on March 10th, 2011. Six of those reactors, the ones at Fukushima Daiichi, are not operating, obviously, and are not going to operate again. But a majority of the other reactors across the country also have closed. Some did experience some effects from the earthquake, obviously not as severe as Fukushima. But Japan has an interesting law where in Japan, reactors after 13 months of operation have to close for inspections, safety inspections and the like, something that we certainly don't do here in the U.S. And another part of the law is that the governors of the prefectures, which is the Japanese equivalent of states, the governors have to approve the restart of the reactors. And if the governor opposes it and doesn't want it, then the reactors can't start up again. So most of Japan's reactors are closed. Most of the governors have indicated they don't want the reactors to reopen, although today, in fact, the first reactor in Japan to restart after Fukushima started, I forget the name of it, but a governor did allow one reactor to start up today. There is a campaign to try to overturn that decision. But, you know, we have a situation where by next spring, the rest of Japan's reactors that are currently operating and have been operating this whole time will be going through their shutdown times. And it's by no means clear that the governors are going to allow the rest of these reactors to start up. So Japan may find itself a no-nuclear or a very small nuclear nation by default and by decree of the governors as early as next spring. Meanwhile, the Prime Minister Kan, not particularly popular in Japan right now because of the mishandling of the Fukushima crisis, but he has made it clear that from the government's perspective, the national government's perspective, Japan has to move away from nuclear power and very aggressively go after or improve energy efficiency. Although Japan is probably the most energy efficient country in the world already, and invest heavily in solar and wind power. And Japan does have pretty substantial wind power resources. And in fact, the offshore wind farms in Japan, although they were a little further from the epicenter than the reactors were, they continued operating throughout the earthquake and tsunami. And there's a lot more potential there for power. But that's the direction that Japan is planning to move in over the next decade.
Now let's talk about the United States, with President Barack Obama reaffirming his commitment to nuclear energy even after the Fukushima accident, but he also closed down the Yucca Mountains waste repository. Could you explain?
Well, there's two things. In the United States, there has been much talk about a nuclear renaissance over the past several years. At one point, we had something like applications for, I don't know, as many as 29 or 32 new reactors. In the U.S., the reality is that no licenses have been granted. No reactors are being built right now. Fukushima itself ended one project that was pretty far advanced in South Texas. NRG Energy, which was the lead sponsor of that project, withdrew after Fukushima, partially because one of its investors was, in fact, Tokyo Electric Power. So that one's already ended. And most of the other projects that have been proposed are running into what is for the utilities an unpleasant reality. These reactors cost too much to build. There are competing power sources that cost less to build and operate. And in fact, we are now at the point where even solar power, which has historically been quite expensive, In many parts of the country now, solar power is cheaper than nuclear power, and those parts of the country where it is not yet will be in the coming near-term future. So that if you're a utility executive trying to decide what you're going to build, and of course there's a lead time involved. Nuclear reactors take about 10 years to license and build at a minimum, and you're trying to look, so if you're a utility executive trying to look 10 years ahead, and even now we're seeing that, you know, solar and wind and whether onshore or offshore, and of course natural gas are not only economically competitive with nuclear power, but economically more beneficial than nuclear power, you'd have to be a pretty strange utility executive to invest heavily in nuclear at this point. And in fact, John Rowe, who is the CEO of Exelon, Exelon is the nation's largest nuclear utility, addressed the American Nuclear Society earlier this week and said that while he believes in nuclear power, the economics aren't there, and that in fact the economics for nuclear power in the U.S. have worsened over the past 2 years, to the point where it just doesn't make sense to build nuclear plants in this country. And that's with or without federal support. And because of the the ongoing budget issues and the deficit issues, we're not expecting any additional federal support for nuclear power to be approved. President Obama had asked for $36 billion in taxpayer money for nuclear loans for reactors. We beat him on that last year, and we're winning on that this year as well, and we don't think it's going to happen. So there, and without federal loans, nothing is going to get built.
Now, the utility says, in its defense, that the next generation of reactors is much better than the Three Mile Island-type reactors, which melted down back in 1979. So, describe this new generation of reactors. Are they really that safe?
Well, let me say two things. The reactors that the utilities are actually considering building, in other words, the ones that they have applied for licenses for, are not really a new generation of reactors. They're sort of a half generation of reactors. I sometimes describe them as the difference between a 1970 Chevy Impala and a 2010 Chevy Impala. I mean, they're obviously the 2010 model is probably safer and gets better gas mileage, but you know, it's not much. You know, it's fundamentally technologically not a lot different from the model 30, 40 years ago. And that's the case with the reactors that the utilities have applied to build. These are evolutionary differences between the reactors that exist now. There are reactor designs out there that are being touted by various nuclear proponents that have various features that appeal to the nuclear proponents, and they basically fall into two different categories. There are what's called the small modular reactors, which are far smaller than existing reactors or any that are planned now. Typical reactor in the U.S. is approximately 1,000 megawatts. These would be anywhere from 50 to about 300 megawatts apiece. So, you know, much smaller. The idea is that, well, if we make them smaller, they'll be cheaper. You could put, you know, several of them together on one site and still produce as much power, but it would be simpler to operate and cheaper to build, in theory. We think in practice, actually, the economic, whatever economic advantage there might seem to be would evaporate in real life, but because, you know, none of these reactors has actually been built, none of them have even been fully designed. But So that's one type of new reactor. The second type are what's called, sometimes called Generation 4 reactors. These, and there's a variety of different ones. What they have in common is that they are all designed on paper. Many of them would have a purported selling feature of using radioactive waste from other reactors as part of their fuel. And this would require implementation of a very large reprocessing structure in the United States that would be expensive, quite dirty, and problematic in a number of ways. In theory, these reactor designs, some of which have been around on paper for many years, some of which haven't, but in theory, these reactor designs would be passively safe, meaning that they wouldn't need a lot of valves and pumps and pieces that can break in order to ensure cooling, that the cooling would occur naturally. We're quite skeptical of all of these designs. One of them is the Integral Fast Reactor. The climate scientist, James Hansen, who we like a lot otherwise, has been touting these, but they another is a gas modular reactor, and pebble bed modular reactor. These are designs that have been around actually for a couple of decades, and nobody's ever built them because the economics of them don't make sense, and they probably don't work as well in practice as they might look on paper. We believe that we have the ability to generate the electricity we need through the sun, through the wind, through the water, through renewable means, and using the energy wisely, which means a combination of efficiency, ensuring that everything is operating as efficiently electrically as possible, and sensible conservation. We can meet our electrical needs with those means. We don't need nuclear power of any kind to meet our electricity needs. And this renewable future is becoming reality faster than anybody is really noticing. I was in California last weekend, and I was talking to a friend of mine who's an executive at a large solar firm, and he was explaining to me that currently in California alone, there are proposals that have been filed with the state for 70,000 megawatts of solar power production. And that's not even including rooftop solar and the types of things that individuals do. By way of comparison, California uses about 60,000 megawatts of power total. And this 70,000 megawatts, that's only what's been, on file now. There's obviously plenty of companies that would want to build more. So solar is a rapidly, rapidly growing technology that is finally here. 30 years ago, after Three Mile Island, I'll have to admit, our side, talked a lot about solar power, but solar power wasn't ready then. Wasn't ready for prime time, wasn't ready to power our nation. Things have changed, and solar power in much of the nation, both solar power plants and rooftop solar, home-based solar, industry-based solar, coupled with wind power, and in some cases, in some parts of the country where it can be done cleanly, geothermal power. These are our energy futures. They're here now, and we don't need the Generation 4 design, reactor designs, or any of the other designs that, regardless of their safety claims, which we're skeptical of, still produce radioactive waste.
And last question, what about Yucca Mountains? If the president has closed down, essentially, the Yucca Mountains waste repository, what are we going to do with nuclear waste?
Well, we have on our website a statement of principles that's been signed, endorsed by literally hundreds of organizations across the United States, including just about all of the big environmental groups and all of the nuclear-oriented groups. And it's called HOSS, H-O-S-S, which stands for Hardened On-Site Storage. And what these principles say is basically we know, and it's clear, there is not going to be a permanent radioactive waste dump in the near future in this country. In fact, there's not going to be one anywhere in the world, but that's a different story. Because of that reality, and some of the groups here would like to see such a repository in place, but where it would be is not been agreed upon yet. But because of this fundamental reality that we have the waste that has been generated and we have to deal with it, the best thing we can do with it right now is to store it on site at the reactor sites in dry casks. We need to get it out of the fuel pools as quickly as it can be, which is after about 5 years in the fuel pool, because Fukushima has shown us the vulnerabilities of fuel pools. We need to get it out of the pools into the casks, and we need to have the casks in such a way that they are protected from both natural disasters and man-made disasters such as potential terrorists and that kind of thing.
I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, our special guest today was Michael Marriott, director of NIRS, a Nuclear Information Resource Service in Washington, D.C. Their website is NIRS.org, N-I-R-S.org. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. And be sure to check out my latest book, Physics of the Future, now a New York Times bestseller. Good day.